From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in May of 2021 when Donald Trump accused a Republican election official of deleting files from the 2020 election. That official was Stephen Richer, an Arizona Republican who worked in Maricopa County. As Ann Applebaum writes in her new podcast, quote, "At first, it felt somewhat impossible for Richer to take this kind of accusation seriously. He knew it wasn't true. He could see all the files on the county computers every day he went to work. They hadn't disappeared at all. So Richer tweeted, 'Wow, this is unhinged. I'm literally looking at our voter registration database on my screen right now. We can't indulge these insane lies any longer.'" End quote. And if Richer thought that would be the end of it, he was wrong. Now, you can't blame him. He's a Republican. He worked on the inside. He had the data. He could prove it. And yet these false claims from Donald Trump started to spread to other Republicans and then to a movement of Trump supporters in Arizona who started to send Richer threats. Applebaum says, quote, "Eastern Europeans are familiar with the idea of ruling by conspiracy. But in contemporary America, this is new. And it's so new, in fact, that I'm not sure Americans realize the significance of it." End quote. That's why Applebaum is co-producing the new podcast series, Autocracy in America. Consider what Richer told her and ask yourself if this sounds like the United States you think you know or if it sounds more like a story out of Eastern Europe, maybe Russia. Richer said, quote, "The breadth of the allegations against me is really breathtaking. Some of it is quite imaginative, and never in a million years would I have thought that somebody would have accused me of shredding ballots from the 2020 election, feeding them to chickens, and then burning the chickens to cover the evidence," end quote. 3 weeks ago, Donald Trump said that if he is elected again, he would jail his political opponents. He told Glenn Beck in an interview that he regretted not following through on the 2016 chance of lock her up regarding Hillary Clinton. He said he would not make that mistake again. He would target anyone who has tried to prosecute or investigate him. Trump even shared a post calling for Barack Obama to be subjected to military tribunals. He shared images of Kamala Harris and Tim Walz and Hillary Clinton and others wearing orange prison suits. And on his Truth Social site, he wrote, quote, "When I win, those people that cheated will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, which will include long-term prison sentences so that this depravity of justice does not happen again. They will be prosecuted at levels never before seen in our country," end quote. Americans do not have experience waking up in a country where the legal system is entirely in the pocket of the few rich or powerful people that control it. Applebaum says that day is not impossible. It might be closer than we think. And we've asked a somewhat frequent guest on this program. We try not to abuse the time of Dr. Valerie Perry, but Valerie is so generous with her time, senior associate with the Democratization Policy Council, and she's back with us, I'm glad to say, in studio here in Rochester. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Evan.
I'm going to start just by asking you, 3 weeks ago when Trump it was kind of a trifecta. He tells Glenn Beck he did kind of regret not actually locking her up. You know, people remember 2016 at his rallies. It was lock her up. And his administration did not seek to jail Hillary Clinton. Well, he said he regrets that. Then he starts sharing these pictures, cartoon pictures, of prominent Democrats, including Kamala Harris, in prison. And then he says that he's going to start prosecuting at levels never before seen in our country. And these are his political opponents who he's going to put in jail. And I thought, number one, that would be the first question asked at the debate the next night. It was not. I thought that would be, naively thought that would be a headline everywhere. It was a headline, but it was kind of a below-the-fold headline. And maybe we're sort of inured to this, but what did you make of that?
No, I mean, I think a lot of people just don't think it's possible to happen here. They still believe in a generally decent judicial system, a generally independent judicial system, especially among the people who are more powerful and who are going through some of these more white-collar crimes, et cetera. I think it's interesting, the anecdote you started out with the gentleman sort of saying he couldn't believe the lies that were being put out there. And that's part of the trick. It's like, it's almost better to have a bigger lie because it means that the autocrats or the wannabe autocrats can demonstrate the total impunity they have and the total control that they seek. And in addition, if it's a big lie, the people listening might be like, well, probably not all of it's true, but some of it must be. And it makes it easier for people who might already be skeptical to try to latch on to something and fall into the notion that you can't believe in anything, that there's got to be a kernel of truth there, which is what the autocrat wants, because it makes it easier, again, to whittle away at these things that we've taken for granted for so long.
It almost seems to me to be kind of a litmus test that the really absurd big lie that, you know, Stephen Richer, a Republican election official, saying after the 2020 election, sorry, everybody who is saying that this was rigged, it was not rigged. I'm part of the system. I'm looking at all the data. It's very clear. When people start saying, well, no. You deleted the files, you printed them out, and you fed them to chickens, and then you burned the chickens. He thought, well, this is so absurd that it will be easily laughed out of the public sphere. And it's like a litmus test. The more absurd, the more it's a test of what autocrats, how durable their support is. Because I would have thought the same thing Richer thought, Dr. Perry, that this is not going to work for Donald Trump. I mean, he's going so far in such an absurd direction. Instead, what it demonstrates is you can almost say anything, get away with anything, yeah?
You can, no. And unfortunately, there's now this supportive information ecosystem that can amplify and build on these lies that come out there. I'm glad you mentioned the issue of memes. I mean, the fact that memes are a perfect way to have plausible deniability and say, oh, we were just joking. We didn't really mean that. It was just funny. It's political professional trolling. And yet it gets into the ecosystem. It detracts from having serious conversations about these different issues. And unfortunately, it makes citizens forget that they should care about these things as citizens and makes it more into infotainment and reality TV, which is what you can really look and see a lot of similarities with. It stops being a serious issue of public policy and starts to be a joke that you can just forward to all of your friends on social media.
Well, let me follow part of the point that Dr. Perry is making. First, I'll tell listeners, if you're wondering about the Stephen Richer story, he ended up this past July running in a Republican primary in Maricopa County for one of the, I think, the county recorder, one of the positions there. And he lost in the primary, in a three-way primary. And he put out a statement saying, unfortunately, in elections, sometimes there are winners and losers, and I'm on the losing side, and we accept the results. Good for him. I mean, just all the respect in the world for Stephen Richer. But now he's not going to be in an office. It's going to be very different in 2024. The infrastructure is going to be different in predominantly Trump-supporting places. But when I think about this idea that, you know, there's a lot of experience around the world where this has happened, and people probably feel like they're losing their minds, right? Like, I'm being accused of something so outlandish. How could my neighbors believe this about me? How could my family? How could the government say this about me? It's a tactic, but I mean, is it hyperbolic to say, well, that's kind of what we see in Eastern Europe. We've seen it in Russia. Is it hyperbolic to say that that's what was happening in Arizona, or that's kind of the landscape that's being set up here? Or is that realistic? How do you see it?
I think that the people who want to use these tactics to further erode social trust and trust in institutions want to say that people who are worried about these issues have, quote unquote, Trump derangement syndrome, that everything we hear that we don't like, that they'll say, oh, there they go, talking about Russia again, talking about Viktor Orban again. And it's gaslighting in a lot of ways. It wants us to stop recognizing and appreciating what we can see with our own eyes and trends that we can see happening. And again, this is all part of trying to get people to give up and tune out and think that they don't have any power or agency to try to say, no, this is not what I want. This is not the system that we want. But it's the tactics of really trying to erode the civic trust that we've taken for granted for a large part of the country's history.
Well, I want to listen to a piece of sound we have that demonstrates my cards on the table here. This is not meant to be a partisan. These conversations really aren't partisan. But to me, what we need are reasonable adult responses to illiberal impulses. So Tim Walz at his rallies occasionally, you know, has a line where he says, you know, he's talking about crime rates, and he says, you know, the crime rate was higher under Donald Trump. And then his big applause line is, and that's not even counting the crimes that Donald Trump's been accused of. And people cheer. And then some of the time, his crowds have, you know, chanted, lock him up. And I want to listen to an example of that. And I want to listen to the way that Walls responds when he realizes the crowd is chanting "Lock him up" about Trump.
Those. Better yet, beat the hell out of him at the ballot box. Beat the hell out of him at the ballot box.
What do you make of that response?
I mean, that's an appropriate response, isn't it? Saying, you know, that we want to change systems, change electoral options through the ballot box, not through violence, not through dirty tricks, and not through putting your political rivals in jail. I think something, and as you mentioned, this should not be seen as a partisan issue. What's important to see, and what a lot of apologists for this type of thinking in this country and elsewhere, is that there's a big difference between having the Department of Justice do its job, investigate claims, seek, look where crimes seem to be happening, put together a case, and see if there's enough evidence to move it forward. There's a difference between that and the system that it seems that Donald Trump has noted he would like to see, where he could direct the investigations he wants to happen to go digging for dirt against his political rivals. And that's what the difference is. It's not that when you look at a lot of the different investigations under the Biden administration or previous administrations, you know, there is malfeasance out there. But it's an issue then of coming from the bottom up and from the professionals, the prosecutors, the investigative teams to determine what's going on, as opposed to making a political witch hunt. And the word witch hunt is useful in this sense as well, because, I mean, Trump is really the first president since Richard Nixon to sort of think that he has the right to control these levers of the justice system for his own personal agendas, basically. And that's what's dangerous, because it's been quite some time since we've seen such a naked appetite for using the system.
I also want to ask you a little bit about political violence. And Dr. Perry and I have not talked before the program. I don't know what you make of the two assassination attempts or close to assassination attempts, one very close, one disastrously close, in Pennsylvania and then the one in Florida. First of all, the one in Pennsylvania has all the hallmarks of something that is not even political violence. I wouldn't even put it in the category of political violence. It was a very sad loner who was posting on his gaming forums that he was going to, we're all going to know his name, he was going to be famous. He had Googled when the DNC was. He wanted to know where it was. He was looking for the first close big celebrity who would be near him in proximity, and he wanted to take them out. It's terrible, but you know, I know a lot of Democrats say he's a registered Republican. Yeah, I don't know that he was a political actor. He's around 20 years old and was just kind of a sad person. It didn't look like it was ideological. The second one was ideological. It was a longtime Republican who this year wanted the Republican ticket to be Vivek Ramaswamy and Nikki Haley. So he's a Ramaswamy Haley guy. But he voted for Trump in 2016, grew to hate Donald Trump, and was apparently planning to try to assassinate Trump. So two disturbed people, one of an act of political violence, one probably not, but now you have J.D. Vance at rallies saying they're trying to kill Trump. They. And they does a lot of work there. I don't know who they is supposed to be. There was one person involved in each. There wasn't a network, and they weren't even part of the Democratic Party. But Vance keeps saying they are trying to do this, which is one thing I want to ask you about. The second thing is he goes on to say, well, they have to tone down their rhetoric about Trump. They can't talk about him being a threat to democracy because you're activating people who want to kill him. And I hope we can all agree that violence of any kind is terrible and should not be acceptable and should not be a tool to use to accomplish any goals. I also want to know what you think of this idea that he wants it to be they, and because of it, you have to stop talking about Trump as a threat to democracy.
No, it's a very convenient strategy, isn't it? Because the use of the they fits into the entire strategy of othering anyone who is not a Trump supporter, and in particular, the scapegoats that are a core of their campaign in terms of trying to divide between real Americans and the other, which would either be Democrats, which they also call communists, fascists, Marxists constantly. So the notion that the hate is only coming from one side is certainly untrue on many different levels. But I think it's also interesting because even if with the first assassination attempt, even if it's just looking for spectacular violence to sort of achieve some internal goal because of their own mental issues. I mean, when you look back to the attempted assassination of Reagan, I mean, that wasn't political violence. It was to sort of try to sort of get Jody Foster on board. So you've got this mentality. But the difference would be is that nowadays you can have something like that happen. And society is so polarized. You've got this entire media, social media system that can plug into this and immediately spread hate and force you to choose sides, which is something you wouldn't have seen back in the early 80s. And so it unfolds in a way that actually creates political violence as a social good in men's, I mean, like a social product, a byproduct of that act, even though it might not have been the intention. And that's what's worrying because it can very easily spiral and lead to people thinking about copycats, lead to language, which can either be, can intentionally, really, in many ways, provoke the other side and make it easier for people to again say, they hate you. If you need to stand with us, you need to find your own people, which just keeps deepening and widening the polarization that we're seeing. And it's unfortunate. And the thing that is worrying as well, though, is that it's really easy to say, you know, this is not what America's about. But America has a pretty long history of political violence. I mean, you can look at the Revolutionary War, which, depending on what side you're on, you can interpret it differently. It's a very different history than Canada had, for example. But there have been several assassination attempts, again, and some successful, some unsuccessful over the years. So the notion that this is a one-off is not true for a fairly young country. We've had our share of political violence in terms of presidential assassinations, but look at all the assassinations in the 60s. It's more common than we might want to admit, and it's very often linked to the vision of American society that people might want to see or might want to prevent.
As you know, J.D. Vance also is eliding the fact that he says they have to stop talking about Trump this way. And minutes later, Trump goes on stage and says that if Kamala Harris wins, this country is over.
Mm-hmm. No, certainly. And I think it was Vance who, after the Pennsylvania attempt, I mean, within hours, if not less, he was going out and blaming Biden and Harris on all of this. So there was no, I mean, the responsible thing would be to say, we deplore this. We are awaiting an investigation. We're not going to turn this into a political tool or weapon. We're going to stop campaigning for a certain amount of time to try to calm things down. That should be the responsible behavior. But unfortunately, in this competitive environment, there's a lot of incentives to not do that and just keep amping up the pressure to try to power up and motivate the base and continue to stoke the othering, which is at the core, especially of the Trump Vance campaign.
Talking to Dr. Valerie Perry, our guest here, who is a senior associate with the Democratization Policy Council. And as I talked about with guests on this program last week, I think the vast majority of human beings, vast majority of Americans are going to bed at night thinking they're on the right side of history. I don't think people are thinking, I support things that are bad for the country, bad for my neighbors, bad for me, bad for my kids, but I got away with it. I don't think people are thinking I'm voting this way because I'm just a coarse or evil person. I don't think that at all. I think people feel very strongly that based on whatever information ecosystem they're in, they're making good, smart decisions. One thing that is not clear to me is just how much Americans have considered what it is like to wake up in a country where if you end up in court, if you end up accused of a crime, that you have a system that is designed to make sure that you have something close to fairness. And that fairness hasn't always extended to all Americans. We know that. And Dr. Perry was pointing out even before the program, I mean, this is unfortunately not true for all Americans, but we do have a system where if I get arrested and accused of something I didn't do, I feel pretty strongly I can hire an attorney and we're going to fight this and I feel like I can win. And there are places in the world where, because of the concentration of power among rich and political actors, that if they decide that you're going to prison, you're going to prison. If they decide you're going away, you're going away. If they decide that you're not going to have certain rights, you're not going to have them. And I don't think that we really have considered what that is like. I think we take it for granted. I probably take it for granted. You know, you've worked in different places around the world. What do you hope Americans are thinking about in this context?
I think the most important thing is that there's no guarantee of immunity against these types of trends. And we should be able to see this. And we shouldn't be able to think that that could never happen here. There's a There's been some interesting reporting on this. Just last week, the New York Times had a very long investigative piece looking at how frequently Trump used the powers of the Justice Department to try to put together cases to go after his enemies. I mean, including Hillary Clinton, a number of others, other people who were pushing back against what he was trying to do. And they ended up being baseless. But it takes up time and resources from the Justice Department. And it sends a chilling signal to enemies, but also people on the inside that you better stay in line because I'm willing to and able to do this to you as well. And so it's really about trying to prosecute the enemies list that might be out there while also trying to deter other people from using their conscience and being a whistleblower, from reporting, from trying to do the right thing. There's also, I mean, the international perspective is interesting as well. There's a book that came out in the past year by David Rode, and he was an international journalist for quite some time. He had famously been held hostage by the Taliban and escaped, and it had also been held hostage in Bosnia during the war by Serb paramilitaries for a short time in 1995. And so he has been researching and doing investigative reporting around the world on war-torn societies, corrupt societies, etc. And then once he escaped from the Taliban, focused a bit more on domestic work. And his book is quite interesting because it's looking specifically at the risks to the justice system in the United States by the erosion of norms and the weaponizing of that system. The book is called Where Tyranny Begins, and it's trying to sort of take the perspective of someone who has seen this happen in other societies that had a middle class, had a working class, had structures that might not have been perfect, but how they could easily be weaponized and have all of the independence basically sucked out of them. Because you can see that here. And the United States is an interesting example because while you've got a federal system, while you've got the various checks and balances, the Department of Justice does occupy a certain area which can be fairly difficult because, I mean, the Department of Justice, the Attorney General is appointed by the President of the United States and is part of the administration, yet at the same time has a responsibility to act independently to investigate and prosecute and try to ensure justice. So a lot of this is resting on and dependent on the hope that the president and their team will do the right thing and not do this. There's not always enough checks and balances to prevent this. And when you think about it, back going into the end of the Trump administration, the fact that there were so many people who were willing to sign and say that they were going to collectively resign if he replaced personnel was significant in stopping that final push going forward. And you can't always assume that the right people are going to be in a place like that to stand up against it. You can't always assume that people are going to listen to journalists who are reporting these things because of their information bubbles. They might not even recognize that the independence is being whittled away. And that's why it really does it requires a recognition that it could happen here, that we're not immune, that we're not better than all of these other countries, and that it really does take vigilance and citizen participation to prevent that slope.
But what you talk about with the end of that administration, with people saying, we're going to resign if X, Y, Z. Well, they were in place. There are a lot of people who've been in place in parts of the bureaucracy for decades, mm-hmm. And going across different administrations. One of the things that J.D. Vance has talked about is this time around, getting in and kind of clearing the deck and replacing thousands of people, even at mid and lower levels, with quote-unquote our people, Vance will say our people, so you don't have those barriers to accomplishing what you want to accomplish. Senator Vance would say, I don't want to accomplish anything illiberal. I want people who are not going to be, you know, obstreperous when we have an agenda to try to carry forward. But if that had been the case in 2019, what you were describing, things would be different, and that's why I think it would be different on day one this time around, because they understand that. They understand that the DOJ, yes, there's a presidential appointee at the top, but there's hundreds or thousands of people would have to carry out that work, and they may not be willing to do it if it's illiberal. But if you know how to clear the deck from the beginning, then you don't have those barriers, right?
No, exactly. And it hasn't been a secret that Trump has wanted to basically destroy the civil service system, of basically having a civil service of technical people who have gone through the process, and replace more and more of those people with political appointees who he can directly control and who will be under a mandate not to serve the country and the Constitution and the jurisdiction, but to serve his interests. And this is very troubling. And we have to watch out, because it will be sold. And you can see in Project 2025, this includes part of this in terms of trying to basically hide the notion of politicizing the civil service sector by claiming this is going to help, quote unquote, drain the swamp. When in effect, by doing something like this, you're taking out all of the safeguards to try to prevent the total manipulation of what are public bodies and public goods by politicians thinking just about their own cronies.
A couple other points on this, and then sometimes I get so caught up with Dr. Perry in diagnosing a problem that we don't spend enough time on solutions. We're going to talk about solutions in a moment. But one other part of this that has been also on my mind, it's the way that these information ecosystems, you brought up memes, but also these different media platforms, which really serve well to spread sometimes lies and powerful actors when they want to tell you that an election is not legitimate, or it's really remarkable how fast that can move. And we know that autocrats in other places have been very effective at using this. I was kind of amazed is the wrong word. I thought at the debate it was pretty remarkable watching how easily manipulated Trump was by Harris when she was trying to push his buttons about, you know, rallies and things like that that are so juvenile, but she was trying to demonstrate, I think, effectively how easily manipulated and off topic he can get by those petty things. The other ways he gets manipulated is by people who like him and people who praise him. And so at the debate, he name-checked these character witnesses who are people who have praised him: Viktor Orban, Kim Jong-un. Which is strange to me, Dr. Perry, because Kamala Harris has been saying in this campaign, these autocrats want him to win. They are rooting for him. Do you see it that way? Do you think autocrats around the world have a stake in this election?
They definitely do, because if the United States goes down that path, then it's one substantially less safeguard against the destruction of the post-World War II liberal order, which, while it was imperfect in many ways, at least was constantly promoting rights-based democracy, human rights, good governance, and basic processes, as opposed to the vision that autocrats want, which is much more based on, again, crony economics and political economies and kleptocracy. And when you think about it, I mean, autocrats want a certain number of things. I mean, they want unaccountable power. They want a lack of opposition. They want a lack of accountability. They want money and jobs for their families and their friends. And they want a media machine that will allow them to control the narrative, while perhaps allowing a few independent journalists to do their thing just to pretend that there's a multiplicity of voices. That's what they want to try to move their agenda forward. So any kind of system that would push against those desires from the autocrats will weaken them. So if they can get someone into power in the United States who not only admits to wanting to cozy up with these guys, but who's willing to whittle away at some of these various institutions in this very country, then they win. And then it gets harder and harder to basically put out there the notion that there's a model for a system where people have the right to expect that they can choose who they want to lead them and hold them accountable. And that's how you can get into a system then where you've got an autocrat and you're either on the inside or the outside, and the inside is less than 1% of the people who are at the top of the pyramid, and then the rest of the people are expected to just either sell out or tune out, basically.
One other piece of sound I want to listen to, and I have a question for Dr. Perry, and the question is basically, what is this about? We're going to listen to a clip of sound. So Senator Vance is going to be on the road for a little while with Tucker Carlson. And Tucker Carlson, of course, former Fox host, who's now a podcaster. And Tucker Carlson recently spent, I think, more than an hour with a man named Daryl Cooper. And Daryl Cooper is, Carlson introduced him as the most important historian in America today. Cooper is someone who has been doing historical work on a number of subjects, but he's also writing a book on World War II. And Cooper, to give you a little bit of background on him, has said that large parts of World War II are misunderstood. A large parts of Hitler are misunderstood. He is much more sort of flippant on Twitter. On Twitter, he recently wrote that he was envisioning the scenario where the two people that Kyle Rittenhouse shot and killed in Kenosha, Wisconsin, were in hell, and they were looking for Hitler, and they were going to be surprised to find out Hitler wasn't in hell, implying that Daryl Cooper thinks Hitler's actually in heaven. Cooper is a different guy, and in this clip, he's telling Tucker Carlson that yes, the Holocaust happened. Yes, the starvation and the killing of huge numbers of Russians happened. But Hitler didn't want a wider war, and probably wouldn't have killed that many people if they were just so successful. They were a victim of their own success. It was really Churchill who was the victim, the worst actor in the war, because Churchill prolonged it. Hitler just wanted more peace. He wanted to conquer Poland. He wanted to conquer parts of Europe. But then he wanted the war to end. And if Churchill would have just let him end it, then we wouldn't have had all of this. Listen to the way Cooper talks about the people who were killed by the Nazis. Listen.
You know, Germany, look, they put themselves into a position, and Adolf Hitler is chiefly responsible for this, but his whole regime is responsible for it, that when they went into the East in 1941, they launched a war where they were completely unprepared to deal with the millions and millions of prisoners of war, of local political prisoners, and so forth, that they were going to have to handle. They went in with no plan for that. And they just threw these people into camps, and millions of people ended up dead there. You know, you have like letters as early as July, August 1941 from commandants of these makeshift camps that they're setting up for these millions of people who are surrendering or people they're rounding up. And so it's 2 months after, a month or two after Barbarossa was launched. And they're writing back to the high command in Berlin saying, we can't feed these people. We don't have the food to feed these people. And one of them actually says, rather than wait for them all to slowly starve this winter, wouldn't it be more humane to just finish them off quickly now?
More humane to gas or put people in shooting firing lines, whether they were Russians captured, whether it was the millions of Jews who were killed in the Holocaust, wouldn't it be more humane? That's an amazing rehabilitation of image there. Also, listen to the passive language. They threw people in the camps and millions ended up dead. They didn't end up dead. That was an intentional campaign of killing. That was the goal from the start of that war. What are we doing here? What is this about, Dr. Perry?
No, it's amazing, isn't it, that you can have... I mean, there have always been people on the fringes who have been promoting such revisionism. But the fact that we now have a presidential candidate and their vice president promoting these lies and this revisionism that should really disgust all of us, it's stunning. And it really is a combination, again, of trying to fire up and recruit the most fringy of their base, which are often do include white nationalists who have bought into a lot of this revisionist history. It's about signaling to the base that they're going to basically pursue their agendas and try to push back against what they see as a liberal elite narrative over the years that they're challenging. And it's also really just trying to... It's successful in sort of, as they would say, triggering the libs in many ways, because, of course, we hear this. People on the news hear this, and it gives a chance for all of us to talk about it on CNN and the media, et cetera. And you never get an answer. And this is the hard thing. When you sort of sell lies, the more you try to fact check and talk about what the truth really is, the easier it can become for people to try to ignore you. And this is, again, the problem with... the bigger the lie, the easier it can be to sustain some of these things and try to really challenge the notion that there can be anything such as a known truth or a known version of history. And we can see this with Trump as well. I mean, it's not a coincidence that this Laura Loomer is out on the scene now as well. I mean, we're less than 50 days out from the campaign, and suddenly he's got another person who's out there who's made a business of selling
hate. She
calls
herself a white nationalist.
And again, it's difficult to say with a lot of these fringe characters, do they really believe this, or is this their business model? And this is what's dangerous, because if it's the business model, like when you think with Alex Jones, for example, he made a lot of money selling these lies. And these aren't stupid people. Stupid people don't build such big empires, but they're opportunistic and, I would argue, amoral. Is that this fits into a system of, again, what feeds autocracy, which is moving away from the notion of a participatory civic democracy and moving towards a system where you have political technologists basically shaping and creating the system that would work for the oligarchs. And this is one of the things that you could see in both Timothy Snyder had an interesting book called The Road to Unfreedom that I read in parallel with Ann Applebaum's recent book. And reading this, one name that comes up quite often in terms of the political technology is Roger Stone, of course, but also Paul Manafort, who is a link with Ukraine, Russia, and a lot of these different deal making. And you see this coming from the American side, and it aids and abets these kleptocratic trends in a country like Russia or many countries in sub-Saharan Africa where Manafort did some very reprehensible representation, while at the same time plugging into corrosive aspects of society in the United States. And so we shouldn't be surprised, for example, that when Trump was using one of his executive powers, which is related to the judiciary of pardoning, that he pardoned Roger Stone, Manafort, Michael Flynn, and all of these people who remained loyal and who he sees that he could probably turn on again and who would work in their interest as well as their own personal financial interests to have, it's self-interested political technology in this way. And it's something that you see in countries like the former Soviet Union and others, but it's something that's newer here, and people have not really appreciated the extent to which this breaks down already tested systems of democratic governance in our country.
As we go to break here, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about possible solutions that Dr. Perry sees. I want to tell listeners, I wasn't trying to cherry pick a piece of sound from the Carlson Cooper interview. I've made myself watch the whole thing. It is really, really remarkable. Carlson claims at one point that the biggest problem with World War II scholarship is that you can't challenge the historical narrative that Churchill was a hero and that, you know, Hitler was the chief villain. And that if you do that, they would throw you in jail, even in the United States. I mean, you talk about baloney. People, his own podcast, they just challenged it with a million people watching. No one got thrown in jail. But we are allowed to say that it's dangerous. It's wild. It's amazing to say that Hitler was not the chief villain of World War II, that we could have seen an ascendant Germany under Hitler, a Nazi Germany, just coexist peacefully, I guess, with the rest of the world after, you know, if Churchill would have just stood down. It's an amazing set of arguments. But anyway, that's who Senator Vance is campaigning with this week. Let's take that break. We're going to come back and talk more with Valerie Perry on the other side. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we bring you back a couple of recent conversations that had a lot of people talking about in the first hour about teenagers, about people in their young 20s, mental health, stereotypes in reality. In our second hour, Democrat and Chronicle journalist Justin Murphy has left that post. He's got a new career. He's talking about what he's doing next and the future of journalism. That's Tuesday. Hey, let me take a phone call. Hey, Robert in Fairport. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious how your guest feels about the authoritarianism during COVID-19. We had a lot of people that were fired from their jobs because they didn't get a vaccine. Even though the vaccine at the time was kind of oversold, it was said at the time that the vaccine would prevent infection. That was not the case. It's also said that if you stayed 6 feet apart from people, that you'd be fine. There was no scientific basis for that. We're only finding out about this now. People were arrested for walking on a beach and things like that. I'm kind of curious how your guest feels about that.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Dr. Perry.
Well, I guess that the first thing I would say is I lived through the COVID pandemic in Bosnia and Herzegovina, where if you got COVID, it was the second country in the world where you had the biggest chance of dying, because this is a country that has suffered from war, polarization, and corruption, which completely gutted the health system. So I would just open that in terms of sort of perspective on this. I worry about this because did the United States handle the COVID pandemic perfectly? No. Did any country? No. Were lessons learned? Yes. And I think a process of learning about this is happening. But I think that it is reasonable. I think it's reasonable to look at what happened and see what worked and didn't work. But I think it's also important to think about the fact that all of that was unfolding during an administration that already was promoting a divisive agenda and building on a generation of anti-government rhetoric and anti-institutional rhetoric in many ways, and failed to really lead this in any way. Imagine a scenario where there would have been a president who actually sort of spoke and said, there is this new threat that we don't know anything about. We need to do this for this reason. Let's do this as a team. Let's try to do this together. Let's try to see that the United States can be the best that they can be by trying to protect the people who are the weakest among us and do the right thing. Imagine if someone would have said, you know, I don't like wearing a mask either, but let's do it because of the old lady down the street. Let's do it because the person at your church or temple has cancer. If it would have been framed in that way, people might have actually sort of felt some sense of social solidarity. Instead, it was done in such a divisive way. And again, I'm sorry, I have to look at some of the politics on this, that it fed into the existing divisions across the board. And it's something that we're still not recovering from. And it worries me because there will be another pandemic. And I fear that socially, it's going to be even harder for the United States to react to it because it's turned into such a political tool.
Robert, last hour we had vaccine researchers on. And vaccines will help limit severe infection. They could shorten a mild infection. They absolutely prevent death for a lot of people who are very vulnerable. And we've still had more than 1 million Americans die of COVID. So, yeah, I mean, you can't go through something like that without making mistakes. And authoritarianism would say that every American must get vaccinated or they're going to lose their job. And that's a government order. That's not what we saw. You don't like that some health system said that nurses had to get vaccinated or some employers said that we wanted people to wear masks. And some of that might have been heavy-handed or went on for too long, sure. But that's not exactly a parallel to the rest of the hour. So I'm going to move off that. I appreciate that, Robert. So we've been talking about a lot of the problems, diagnosing the problems. Take me through some of what you think might actually constitute solutions to this.
Now, I think one of the things we need to, first of all, recognize is that the rise in autocracy, the rise in kleptocracy, and the Venn diagram overlap between those two is quite thorough, could not have happened without the role of a lot of Western institutions, whether that's banks, financial systems, and real estate transactions. As the Soviet Union was falling apart, as we started to see global capitalism take go on to full speed and privatization of formerly state-owned enterprises, et cetera. This money that was being made was being offshored into banks in New York, in London, et cetera. It was being put into investments of real estate, et cetera, and into various financial investments in the West, precisely because those are trustworthy and reliable, and even oligarchs want to put their money someplace safe. And this was all done at a time when people weren't thinking, well, where is this money coming from? Was it stolen? What was it supporting? Was it coming from a warlord that is fighting an insurgency in a certain place? So it's high time to start having more more of an understanding among these banks and financial institutions of where that money's coming from. There needs to be tighter regulation in terms of shell companies that have been doing the dirty work and facilitating the dirty work of these autocrats for so many years. And also, the notion that real estate purchases can be made with people buying up apartments in New York City and London, et cetera, without even mentioning who the owner is just a recipe for money laundering. And so having tightening up American legislation on those issues would be a step in facilitating a cleaner international financial system while also trying to inoculate us from abuse here. And I would challenge that the politicians, the Congress men and women and the senators who are against that should explain why they're against that. Explain why they're against trying to clean up a financial system that the vast majority of Americans don't even see, but which facilitates the very forces that are basically corroding the democracy that we see. And this is all related to the broader anti-corruption the need for an anti-corruption crusade, basically. Unfortunately, it's been easy for Americans to give up on the notion that democracy works because they'll say, all politicians are corrupt. Look, he took a bribe.
Yeah, it's nihilistic.
Yep,
yeah. Well, they're all the same.
They're all the same.
Yeah.
And I think that recognizing that you need to have the systems and the structures to prevent corruption is necessary. A lot of people, and I'm included in this, Citizen United has done a ton of damage in terms of bringing money into the political system that's unaccountable and is anti-democratic and would have to be reversed or mitigated by Congress. And seeing something happening to take that money out of politics is critical. And there's been bills put forward by Elizabeth Warren and others. And again, I think it's important for citizens to think, I wonder what my senator or congressperson of whatever party, I wonder what they think about that. I wonder why they wouldn't want to support a cleaner government in this way. And those steps are necessary to restore the trust and restore the notion that politicians are only there for self-dealing. And this goes on both sides. I mean, at some point, I remember a lot of people were complaining about Nancy Pelosi and the fact that some of her family business dealings were questionable, and people had been wondering whether she was profiting from this. The easiest way to try to clean this up is to make sure that people who are working in the public trust have to be transparent, have to put their stocks into a blind trust, so there's no possibility for the appearance of malfeasance or corruption. And I start with corruption because, again, corruption corrodes trust and it corrodes solidarity and it corrodes democratic norms and institutions. The information ecosystem is critical as well. And I know that you've spoken quite a bit about local media and the fact that local media has really been devastated in this country in so many ways. And so I think that in addition to looking for new models of local media that serve the community and hold mayors and local city council people to account is critical. Trying to get people to recognize that they might complain about the cost of subscribing to a newspaper, et cetera, but then think about how much money is being spent on streaming services every month. There needs to be some sort of a discussion about civic accountability and participation and what citizens need to be prepared to do so that they, too, can be a part of holding their communities to account. I think the tougher thing, though, is going to be how to regulate and deal with the misinformation and the corrosive dynamics of social media that we're seeing. And Anne Applebaum talks about this a bit as well, and many others have talked about how do you regulate these social media companies in a way that they hold some responsibility. They've basically opened up a completely toxic environment for everything from threats and bullying to pedophilia, pornography, all of these different opportunities can come forward, and yet the tech companies put up their hands and say, we're just a platform. I mean, there's no way that any of these companies, if they were in the real world, would be allowed to get away with this. And yet we've let them get away with this. Trying to make sure that there's better regulation on these, that there's more accountability required, that they can't just put their hands up in this way is critical.
I'd be nervous that regulation could be heavy-handed here. And I'm not saying there is a perfect, easy formula for this. But I also recognize that it is a very, not only just an ugly place, these platforms, I'm thinking of X, but I mean, they're very, very ugly, but they can be breeding grounds for very dangerous ideas and organizing.
Well, so much of it comes down to the algorithm, doesn't it? I mean, if Elon Musk is feeling unloved, he can tweak the algorithm so that more people see what he's saying. And that's not a perfect way to run a democracy. And people see that more and more. Ideally, we would see more people wonder and ask themselves, is it really worth it for them to be giving away all of their personal information to companies who are profiting from it and destroying their communities all at the same time? That's a fundamental rethink of how we think about these things. And it would be good to see more politicians talking about trying to move this forward. And I think in the past year or so, one of the only things that have really brought Democrats and Republicans together on the Hill has been talking about some of these issues with tech. And I hope that they'll get more on the same page in terms of the social media aspect. But it's worrying to think that it's going to be even worse with AI. And we're seeing that already in this current campaign. And throwing our hands up and saying it'll never work is not enough. I mean, this is code being written by people in Silicon Valley who should be held by account. There should be transparency in the algorithms. They're profiting from tax breaks. They're profiting from infrastructure. They're profiting from public education. There should be some accountability.
Well, Elon Musk has said recently that he now views Twitter or X as the public square. And if you want to make the argument that this is the new version of the public square, to me it says, in the same way that we talk about the internet or Wi-Fi, internet access as a utility, the rules change a little bit. when you define it that way. If this is the public square, then maybe it can be regulated differently.
And it should be. I mean, and it's interesting. He stepped back in this recent case with Brazil, where he didn't want to comply with the laws there. And that kind of pressure is necessary. I think the problem is this tech love affair with people thinking, oh, these are visionaries, et cetera, has allowed a lot of leeway that shouldn't have been there. And we need to recognize, while there's a lot of smart people out there, they're in it for the money. I mean, these are not people who are curing cancer. These are people who are finding ways to push Nazi cat memes at you faster so that they can profit from it. And that's why more transparency really needs to be required and demanded, both through regulation, but then also by the users. And I think the other thing I would mention is political accountability in general. And when you look at this, it consistently comes back to structural issues. Independent redistricting is needed. I mean, the gerrymandering in this country is part of what's polarized people. I mean, none of these maps should look the way they do. And both parties are guilty of this. And in different states, certain parties are better at it than other parties. And
absolutely.
So everyone's guilty on this one. And it's amazing that more people aren't saying, wait a minute, this makes no sense that we've got this ridiculous looking district that really doesn't create any representation for me. And so that's one of the structural things that needs to be done. And I think I would just close with sort of noting that what we can see already with the Trump campaign seeking to claim that the election system is broken and biased against him and can't be trusted is extremely dangerous. I mean, the federal system in this country means that it's actually extremely hard to play with the system because there's so many local level independent bodies dealing with it. It's been demonstrated by studies time and again for years that the amount of intentional voter fraud is minuscule. And so this is all really part of an effort to, again, whittle away trust, but also to create the environment so that if they don't get the results that they want, they can start to challenge it. And it's interesting to see this because I had gotten my start in working in Bosnia by being an election monitor in the first post-war elections in that country, local elections in that country in 1997. And they sent in a lot of internationals like me to basically be in the polling stations and assist and watch and observe and make sure there was no pressure, make sure people with guns didn't come in, make sure that political parties weren't trying to steal or shred ballots, et cetera, so you'd have a fair count. And that's necessary today as well. It's necessary to have people in the polling station monitoring this so people have trust in that very basic element.
Ooh, that's a 10-minute block of things that could actually help. And I want to just thank Dr. Valerie Perry for making the time for this program, a senior associate with the Democratization Policy Council. Thank you for sharing your expertise. We look forward to the next conversation.
Thanks, Evan.
And listeners, if you emailed, called these 2 hours, got a lot of your feedback in, but got as much as we can in. It's tough, but we try to bring in your voice as much as possible. It is a pledge week. We're trying to grow the community of members, and I would urge you, if you are not a member, if you're public radio, get online at wxxi.org/give. Join that community today. Thank you for supporting your public radio.